Hello and welcome to Hindsight. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, two stories, largely set on the beautiful island of Tasmania, stories which explore the legacies of colonial settlement. Later, tales from the bizarre and macabre history of the collection of Aboriginal human remains from the 19th century in the name of science, and the long struggle to have them returned. The act of collection itself, whether driven by curiosity or greed, was a big part of the colonial enterprise. Alongside the theft of human remains, the material culture of Aboriginal Australians was of great interest to many settlers. One keen collector was the surveyor John Helder Wedge, who arrived in Van Diemen's Land in 1824. He's remembered today for mapping isolated parts of the island, Peria, and founded Melbourne. Wedge sent his large collection of artefacts to his father in Britain, where they ended up in the local museum in the town of Saffron Walden. A large number of those same artefacts are in a new exhibition which opened this month at the National Museum in Canberra. Through the writings of John Helder Wedge, the work of historians Bain Attwood, Carol Cooper and Lyndall Ryan, our producer Fiona Gruber explores Wedge's role in the early history of two colonies.
These people are commonly called savages.
John Helder Wedge was somebody who was a very moral man.
But I much doubt, judging from the atrocious acts of barbarity that have marked the career of Europeans amongst them, whether the white man is not the more deserving of that epithet.
A humanitarian who appeared to want to do the best by Aboriginal people.
There's no doubt that these men and the Port Phillip Association are what can be described as land grabbers.
7th of April, 1828, Cape Grim. For the last 6 days, we were without provisions, except for that provided by Providence, namely two kangaroos and a strayed lamb belonging to the company.
Wedge was one of a number of surveyors who came to Van Diemen's Land at that time, and they all made the most extraordinary journeys over land where few white people had ever been before.
Wedge arrived in Tasmania in 1824. He was a person who was looking to make a new life and a better life in Australia. He was a trained surveyor. His father was a surveyor. He came to Tasmania. He got a land grant at Leylands, which is near Launceston.
Wednesday, the 11th of April, 1827. Commenced my journey to explore the southwest part of the country. I intended to have stopped till the following morning, but from the appearance of the weather, I was fearful the river would rise and prevent my fording it.
It's very rugged country. A lot of that part of Van Diemen's Land, even today, are rugged forests, high mountains, very difficult climate, you know, warm in the morning, a snowstorm in the afternoon. And he records all of that in his diaries so well. And there are days when he just has to sit in his tent and it's pouring with rain.
7th of April, 1828. I was fearful the river would rise and prevent my fording it. For the last six days, we were without provisions. The weight of our provisions and blankets, except for that provided by and a strayed lamb, accompanied by the dogs, we commenced.
One gets the sense that men like John Helder Wedge were reading the novels of Sir Walter Scott and were very taken up with his ideas of free, independent Highlanders. You can almost see these men acting out the sense of them being characters in Rob Roy. There's a real spirit of independence, I think, in Van Diemen's Land. And there is a streak of romanticism, I think, in those like Wedge. It probably meant that their judgment was not always very sound, that they were attracted to the fantasy of colonising, another land.
Just as we were preparing to start after breakfast, I walked a short distance from my party when my notice was suddenly attracted by a native standing perfectly motionless with a bunch of spears on his back. I told the men what I had seen, and they immediately went on the lookout. They soon observed about 16 men armed with spears. A shot was fired by one of my party at one of the natives with a raised spear. He jumped up a great height and then fell down, one of them, then ran into the sea. In order, I suppose, to decoy my men from their pursuit. The boy in the water remained swimming in the very heavy surf. It was the finest specimen of swimming I ever witnessed. He wouldn't come out. One of my men had fired at him, and was at length washed on shore, apparently lifeless from the cold. It was a boy of about 10. He very soon became reconciled to the change, and has continued with us ever since.
It was not uncommon for surveyors in particular to have some Aboriginal boys, particularly boys, with them. Men like Wedge, who were on the move. He carried a tent, he had a small party of men with him. And the Aborigines always respected men who are on the move.
The boy tells us that blacks track game and white men by their smell. His name is Weta Koolera, and I have called him Mayday.
Mayday is often described telling Wedge about particular rocks, the meaning of particular trees, the particular mountains and land, all of this kind of information which surveyors truly value. So I think that Wedge and Mayday had a very important relationship.
Mayday's disposition was good, and kindness was never wasted on him. He received it from many during my wanderings through the country. He accompanied me to Hobart Town, and at a large party one evening, he was told to kiss one of the ladies. After a considerable deal of pressing, he went up to her, and, gently touching her neck, he kissed his fingers. This exhibited a delicacy of feeling which his fairer brethren need not be ashamed to imitate. He completely disproved the common aspersion that the Aborigines of this island are hardly more intelligent than brutes. He died after living with me a little over 2 years, from inflammation of the lungs. He was an attached and faithful friend, and always told the truth.
I think that Mayday was of immense use and value to Wedge in describing him the different tribal areas in which Wedge was travelling, which land belonged to which tribe, which people that Wedge was going to need to meet if he was going to go into their country. And often these boys operated as sort of messengers and diplomats, taking Wedge from one tribal country into another.
These people are commonly called savages, but I much doubt, judging from the atrocious acts of barbarity that have marked the career of Europeans amongst them, whether the white man is not the more deserving of that epithet.
Wedge arrived in Van Diemen's Land just as the Black War, as we call it, kind of broke out. Because the land was being settled with vast numbers of sheep on the Aborigines' kangaroo hunting grounds, it was causing immense violent conflict that went through many stages, including the Black Line, which was one particular campaign right in the middle of the Black War to try and drive the Aborigines out of the settled districts, which was where all the sheep and cattle were located. Obviously, this didn't work, and people like Wedge were very critical of the whole campaign. The organisers did not understand anything about Aboriginal people and how they used the land and how they would be able to slip through the line because it wasn't open country, and that the Aborigines were just critical of the whole idea of the Black Line.
From what I have seen and experienced, it is my strong opinion that the natives of this island are naturally peaceful. And when they are peaceful, and when they are involved in hostility with other tribes, I imagine it is because they have encroached on each other's hunting grounds or abducted each other's women.
It certainly didn't drive the Aborigines from the settled districts, but it did indicate to the Aborigines that the colonists meant business, that they were after the Aborigines and they were determined to remove them come what may. And in the end, the Aborigines were dispossessed and were taken to an island in Bass Strait. So by the mid-1830s, there were virtually no Aborigines left in Van Diemen's Land. And I think Wedge was very anxious that that should not happen in Port Phillip.
Their hostility towards ourselves is due entirely to the injuries that we have scourged them with, which are both so revolting and at the same time so notorious that they need not here be further alluded to.
You briefly mentioned sheep, because you said to me earlier that, yes, he was looking for land that was good for sheep, and he could see straight away that there wasn't a lot of good land in Tasmania. He knew from an early on that he had to look across Bass Strait for the really good land.
Yes, that's very true. He very quickly realised that Van Diemen's Land was limited in its opportunities for grazing sheep. You do need a fair amount of land. You need a few thousand hectares to successfully run sheep. And he realised that with the changes wrought by the Industrial Revolution, that a few hundred sheep was no longer enough to make a living. You needed many thousands. It became more and more specific about the kind of country you needed. And Wedge realised very quickly that there was limited land and much of the good land had already been taken up. At the same time, the British government decided that the land grant system would cease and that from the end of 1831, settlers would have to purchase land or perhaps lease it from the government if they wanted to increase their holdings. And that was something that most settlers were simply not prepared to do. So by 1830, he and a number of settlers are looking across Bass Strait at this place called Port Phillip.
7th of August, 1835. Dear Batman, look for the best situation to form the establishment upon. From what I have at present seen, I think the freshwater river at the head of the bay will be the place. My intercourse with the natives was an interesting adventure, and I was highly satisfied with the prospect of a permanent friendly feeling being established, that with the proper steps being taken, the friendly intercourse already established by Mr. Batman might be made permanent.
In terms of the body of men that we know as the Port Phillip Association, which, in my view, was the one that first proposed that they do a treaty in Port Phillip.
And that by organising a treaty with the Aboriginal people around present-day Melbourne, they could live in peace with each other, that they would find a modus operandi whereby the Aborigines would be compensated for selling their land and that they would be given the benefits of British education and that in time the Aborigines would become just like white people and sort of disappear into the colonial population.
22nd of April, 1839. Your Excellency, I hope I may be allowed to mention that it was mainly through my exertions and recommendations during my first visit to Port Phillip in 1835, about a month after Mr. Batman's treaty with the native tribes, that the friendly communication commenced by that gentleman was made permanent, and the natives partly brought into habits of industry, by which I was enabled to traverse the country amongst the natives for nearly 3 months, attended by only one white man.
Wedge's role is a very important one in the treaty. It seems as though he was the one who first proposed this treaty, although having said that, we need to recognise that there was probably a good deal of treaty talk going on in Van Diemen's Land at the time. The governor of Van Diemen's Land, George Arthur, thought that there'd been a fundamental mistake made in Van Diemen's Land as a result of a treaty not being made at the outset. But it's important to note that there were members of the Port Phillip Association about who is sovereign. There's no doubt about who has authority in Port Phillip. It's the New South Wales government, and the strategy you are pursuing of making a treaty with Aboriginal people, of pretending that you will acknowledge that they are sovereign and thereby grab some land and persuade government to accept that. This is a very foolhardy strategy. Wedge was told that in no uncertain terms by one of the members of the Port Phillip Association, but he ignores it. You almost get the sense with both Wedge and Batman that they thought they could form government themselves, that they could become the rulers in this new area. And on the one hand, you can understand that because this is a lawless territory. There is no obvious form of British government there. But there's also a sense there where I think they were playing out a fiction in their own minds.
Great tact will be required, and one false step may undo all that has been done. All must show great forbearance when any supposed acts of aggression take place on their part, as, without meaning to do wrong, they sometimes act in a way we would consider the opposite of fair dealing.
Why was Wedge so interested in a treaty? What was it about his values that would make him a proponent of that idea?
Well, the treaty probably has two ideas behind it. One is to do with sovereignty, and the other is to do with peace. Now, the men of the Port Phillip Association had at least one fundamental problem. They wanted to settle in Port Phillip. They wanted to acquire land there. But several years earlier, permission to settle there had been denied them by the government of New South Wales. So they're trying to find a way around this problem of authority over this territory. And the idea of the treaty is that it proposes that the Aboriginal people have sovereignty rather than the government of New South Wales. And so if you say, well, the government of New South Wales does not have sovereignty, it does not have authority over this area, and you say the Aboriginal people have authority, and you enter into a treaty with them by which you purchase their land, you then, in your own eyes, acquire the right to territory. But the hope, of course, is that you're going to be able to persuade government to allow you to go ahead and do that. So it's a kind of game, if you like. In the American context, this was often called the deed game. There's no doubt by this time that one of the key symbols in humanitarian discourse is the famous treaty by William Penn in North America. This is a well-known treaty, not simply within Quaker circles, Penn being a Quaker, but within evangelical Christian circles. And so it's striking that when John Batman returns to Van Diemen's Land after doing the treaty, or claiming to have done the treaty in Port Phillip, one of the newspapers in Van Diemen's Land hails him as the
Tasmanian Penn. Launceston, Van Diemen's
Land. Cornwall Chronicle, 13th of June, 1835. Mr. Batman arrived yesterday from Port Phillip. We are informed that he has purchased from a tribe of natives about 500,000 acres of land, taking his boundaries from a short distance in the rear of Port Phillip. The peaceable disposition shown on the part of the holders of the new country enabled Mr. Batman to execute the object of his visit effectually and speedily. Mr. Batman was provided with deeds in triplicate, the nature of which he explained to the chief as the fashion upon such an occasion in white man's country. The payment of the land in part consists of 100 blankets, tomahawks, knives, flour, etc., and it was mutually agreed that a certain quantity of food, clothing and arms were to be paid.
Only evidence from the time that we have of a treaty taking place is from Batman himself and the men, the white men that were amongst his party. We have no contemporary records from the Aboriginal side. And so, as I say, we cannot actually be sure whether that treaty ceremony took place or not. And in some ways, you might say it doesn't really matter whether it happened or not. You might say what's more important is that in the year or so, or longer period of time after the treaty was allegedly done, that both Aboriginal people and members of the Port Phillip Association came to tell a story about that treaty. In other words, I think it's important to recognise that from the Aboriginal point of view, they had considerable investment in the notion that a treaty had been done. However unsatisfactory the terms might have been, in the end, of course, this is the only treaty that we know was done in the Australian context, and the treaty, of course, recognises that the Aboriginal people are the owners of land.
I am satisfied that with the proper steps being taken, the friendly intercourse already established by Mr. Batman might be made permanent.
So men like Wedge were evangelical Christians, though have often been called humanitarians by historians, that they were concerned that colonising Port Phillip would not affect Aboriginal people in the way it had affected them in Van Diemen's Land. They also hope that they will be allowed to acquire this land if they can appeal to humanitarian sentiment, not so much in the Australian colonies, but back in England. At this time, the Colonial Office is dominated by humanitarian figures, and so they are trying to appeal to these humanitarian sensibilities. It's as though they're saying, well, we will prove to you that we are morally virtuous, and the treaty is a sign of that virtue. In terms of those who are on the ground in Port Phillip, there's no terms of trying to help, trying to do the right thing by Aboriginal people. He not only draws up plans for civilising and Christianising Aboriginal people here, plans for better management of what became Melbourne, but from August 1835, he's the one that's on the ground trying to ensure that Aboriginal people are going to be supplied with food in the hope that this will bring them into the small white settlement and ease relations between them.
These people are commonly called savages, but I much doubt, judging from the atrocious acts of barbarity that have marked the career of Europeans amongst them, whether the white man is not the more deserving of that epithet than the man of colour. And I fear the stain is as indelibly fixed on the English, if not more so, than that of any other country.
There's one striking letter in which he expresses great concern that there is what he calls a stain on the reputation of the British. Now, this notion of a stain is one that you can find in a number of writings at the time. In other words, this is a notion that the British have acted shamefully and their reputation as a benevolent nation is going to be very much affected. And I think men like Wedge were very much concerned about how they were going to be seen in the eyes of God.
These men who are very well educated and make a career in the colonies and then marry, you know, in their late 30s or 40s or even early 50s, and then their young wives die. It's a tragic story, which we lose that sort of personal tragic side and how you have to keep going. And Wedge is one of those men who survives for an incredibly long period of time and has left us with a great body of work that could readily become the basis of a wonderful biography.
From the catalogue of the Saffron Walden Museum, 1844. Items donated by John Helder Wedge, Esquire. 12 long arrows, 8 rude spears of wood, some tipped with bone.
We've got the great honour to be able to borrow the Wedge collection that was made in the 1830s and deposited at the Saffron Walden Museum.
Please find enclosed some weapons used by the Aborigines of Van Diemen's Land. A shield of wood, ornamented with zigzag pattern, filled up with a white substance. A hand shield, ornamented all over, It may be wondered what naked people who have no fixed residence can have to enter into such conflicts.
Hobart Mercury, 26th of November, 1872. Death of the Honourable John Helder Wedge on 22nd November at Midlands. Information was received in town yesterday of the death of another old colonist, and one who figured conspicuously both in Tasmania and Victoria many years ago. The funeral takes place today.
The journals of John Helder Wedge were read by Humphrey Bower, and our thanks to curator Len Pohl and the staff of the Saffron Walden Museum. If you'd like more information about the new exhibition at the National Museum of Australia, which showcases some of the artefacts collected by Wedge, then just head to the Hindsight page, abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. This is ABC Radio National. I'm Lorena Allam. And coming up, one of the darkest legacies of colonial collection. In the 19th century, medical men and scientists, often at the behest of some of the world's great museums, collected human remains from across the globe for study and measurement, and they had a special interest in the bones of Aboriginal Australians. Though many institutions have begun returning ancestral remains to their places of origin, there are still others who, in the name of science, are resisting the strong argument for repatriation. In this extract from the feature program Travelling Bones, first broadcast on Hindsight in 2008, I examine the legacy of this colonial history in Australia and the protracted legal and moral battles of today.
The actual scattering of Truganini's ashes took only a few seconds. So quick, in fact, that many newsmen in the spectator fleet of seven boats didn't see it. There was no eulogy, just a murmur in memory of Truganini. And afterwards, the only visible reminder was a wreath of purple sea lavender floating in the channel.
Sacred ground. Keep me from the cold.
My name's Caroline Spotswood from the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre.
My name's Rodney Gibbons. I'm an Aboriginal community member. I guess we'd have to say that we are not talking about our ancestors' bones at all. What we're talking about is their connection to the earth, their spiritual connections. Any remains of our ancestors that are overseas are simply not at rest. They need to come home to their ancestral spiritual place and to be put at rest properly here. Roughly around about 1972-73, when I was discharged from the military, I came back here and there was a little bit of a campaign starting up about Truganini's remains. Then after that, the biggest thing for me was being involved with the Crowther Collection, which talked about 40-odd individuals being held in the Tasmanian Museum. And upon their successful return and their successful cremation down at Oyster Cove, you could see the community, in a sense, getting more restless and more determined to bring all of the ancestors home. They were feeling that they were meeting an obligation to bring everybody home to the place of their ancestral birth and to set their spirits free.
Edinburgh University has one of the largest collections of Aboriginal remains. Next Wednesday, Rodney Gibbons and Denise Gardner will fly to Scotland to bring them home.
So we bring them home to finally set their spirits free, give them some dignity.
I went across with a person by the name of Denise Gardner. We were probably the first pair to go across and bring a lot of remains back. Our main role was to go to Edinburgh and pick up William Lanny and the remains of 12 other people. There was obviously a lot of research and negotiation done behind the scenes by the TAC for a few years leading up to that. But Denise and I had the role of going around Europe and England, Scotland to talk to people about where we knew Tasmanian Aboriginal human remains were. The British Museum and everybody like that refused to meet us. We even went up and knocked on their doors and basically we were thrown out. But that was our role, and we thought that in the long run we were creating some kind of knowledge within that system, that we weren't going away. We were going to come back and back. And if it meant we had to knock on a door and get thrown out every time, there will be a time when you'd sit and listen. And eventually, obviously, they did. We got back to London and set off to Edinburgh, and this is where everything started to go pear-shaped for Denise and I. They still argued that we shouldn't have them back, that they needed them for extra research. And in the end, Denise and I just had to put our foot down and say, look, we're here to get the remains, give them to us. And then they turned around and said, we haven't got them. And what they had done was sent them all down to London the week before. So back to London we went, and they sent them to Australia House. We went in, they had the storage boxes of where the remains were. Denise and I walked in. I could see that Denise was getting a little bit emotional, so I said to all the office staff, could you leave us alone, please? And not a question out they went, and then Denise and I just spent our time with the remains. But after that, we would not let those remains out of our sight. So we put them in a taxi, took them back to our hotel rooms, and Denise won the toss, so they went into her room for her to look after, and one of us would always be in that room. Then we put them back in a taxi and took them out to Heathrow Airport, and that's where we had to say goodbye to them, in the sense that we were allowed by security and other arrangements to watch them being loaded onto the plane. When we got into Hobart, Denise and I were the first ones off the plane. We went down the stairs around to the hold. They opened up the hold. I climbed in, got the boxes, and then Denise and I carried them over to a fair gathering of the community that were waiting for us. They were handed over to our elders.
It was an emotional time for hundreds of Tasmanian Aborigines. Ancient remains and artefacts finally returned to the state after a long battle.
Just look at them. It means everything to us.
And then they were taken down to Oyster Cove, and there was a bit of a community gathering and celebration on their return. William Lanny and the other 12 that we brought back, it was probably one of those rare occasions when we actually knew who they all were and where they come from.
That's Rodney Gibbons. By 2000, after decades of campaigning, the repatriation movement received some official government support here and in the UK. Rodney Dillon sits on the National Indigenous Repatriation Committee.
In 2000... John Howard and Tony Blair got together and said that, you know, that this was unacceptable and they needed to do something about it for these remains to come home, because they both thought that it was very important. So Tony Blair went back to England and talked about setting up a committee. That committee did recommend to make changes to the Living Tissue Act so those remains could be repatriated.
The Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre, or TAC, and the British Natural History Museum have been battling for about 20 years about the repatriation of 17 ancestral remains from the museum's collection. Because law in Britain had been amended in 2000 to allow museums to deaccession or return material, the Natural History Museum conceded, but it decided to conduct last-minute DNA tests on the bones before they gave them back. Caroline Spotswood from the TAC takes up the story.
They agreed that you can have your ancestors, but then they declined to provide the information that they were going to take DNA sequencing from our ancestors. And that's when the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre decided, Michael said, no, you are not doing that, and court injunctions were put in place.
Just let people know who was on your legal team.
We had Geoffrey Robinson, he was our QC, Mark Stevenson, who's a top lawyer in the UK, and we had also Professor Norman Palmer. He was the chair of the committee who wrote a report on cultural property and Indigenous remains within museums within the UK. They wanted to be very much part of this case to fight for the rights of Aboriginal people in Tasmania. And it was an experience sitting in the room with them.
Well, tell us about that.
It's scary. Because you've got to remember, we weren't sitting in a court. We were sitting in mediation. So the mediators were Sir Lawrence Street and Lord Wolfe, Harry Wolfe. And they were the mediators. And
Harry Wolfe was acting on behalf of the British Natural History Museum.
Yes.
And Sir Lawrence Street represented the TAC.
Yes.
And this was because you wanted the remains returned as
that's
they
correct.
Were.
Yes.
And the Natural History Museum wanted to continue further testing.
That's correct.
And so what was the outcome after 20 years of research and lobbying this museum, costly legal campaigns? What eventually was the outcome in that room?
Basically, Greg and I brought our ancestors home. The debate came down to the vials of DNA. For the museum to return the vials to us, there was a compromise on the best way to get them back home.
Yeah. So the Natural History Museum had to hand over the remains that they had.
Yes.
Have they since been reburied?
We've done what's appropriate in regards to a ceremony, and for our ancestors, they've been safely returned home and their spirits have been set free.
Yeah, there's other museums that's doing it as well. They're not the only one. But Cambridge has got a collection as well, and they've stated that they've been hell-bent on holding onto those remains and not being very human about it.
How much do you think is left in overseas museums? Clearly there's a lot still left in Britain after 20 or 25 years of campaigning. What are you aware of exists in other European institutions?
There's some in France and in Germany and in Austria as well, but I think you'd find that other smaller countries would have remains as well. A lot of countries took remains. There's not only public collections, but there's private collections, and that's where it's going to make it hard to get those remains back from those private collections as well.
Private collectors do hand back human remains from time to time, sometimes in bizarre ways. Caroline Martin, the manager of Bunjalaka, the Indigenous Gallery in the Museum of Victoria, explains.
I don't know why, but I actually went over to the other side of the museum to pick up my mail. And I saw this box. And so I stopped at another colleague's, a very close colleague of mine's office, and I was just chit-chatting away and started to open the box. And in the box was lots of newspaper. And I opened up the newspaper. I opened up the newspaper, and it was Hessian, and I pulled it back, and it was actually an ancestral skull. And you know, it's like, oh my god! I close the box, and I go, we've got to go to Mike.
Mike Green is the head of the Indigenous Cultures Department at the Museum of Victoria, and an anthropologist.
The note indicated that the remains had been found in a house in Western Melbourne, and that they were likely to have been collected from the Northern Territory sometime during the Second World War. Early 40s was what the note indicated. And it's not unusual for deceased estates, effectively, to turn up interesting sorts of mementos and curios from past experiences. And this is not the first time that we would have actually received remains that have been collected by soldiers and nurses stationed up in the north during the war. But I don't think these remains actually are from the Territory. I think they are actually from southeastern Australia based on aspects of the shape and size of the skull.
When you found that out, what happened for
Mike
you then?
Mike actually said to me about the note, and then said, he's a man, and he's from, he believed he was from Victoria, and it's from the Murray River. And Went for a walk and I came back and I felt good. I felt sad, very, very sad, and I'm very, very sad. But I felt good because I'm also from the Murray River. And Mike's actually offered me the opportunity to be a part of the full process to return him home.
It had been in a private collection, so to speak, and they'd just decided to send it to you?
It was just addressed to the Bundjalaka Aboriginal Cultural Centre. I'd rather them at this museum so we can give them home to the people than have them in people's cupboards.
Caroline Martin and Mike Green of the Museum of Victoria. About 4 years ago at the museum, I met Gary Murray. Gary is a Dja-Dja-Rung man who's taken on the role of repatriating Aboriginal human remains to communities along the Murray River. He's showing me through the skeletal remains while museum staff pack them into boxes. We're looking at a full woman skeleton lying on a table.
There you go, so if you have a look at that one. It's got a cement slab on there or something.
There's a whole, that's a whole person, just about.
Just about, yeah, just about.
And so how do you work out where that person is from?
There are some records, for example, at these index cards, when they probably would have bought them in what, 1907 acquired. They've got some basic stuff. And in this group that were taken home, of the 180, 200, I suppose it would be about 40 women, probably some kids and all that sort of stuff.
And where's home?
Basically, they come along from that, say, Echuca to Mildura, down the South Australian border, along the river, because you've got a sand dune there. We didn't have shovels, right? So you'd pick a nice soft spot close to the river, the billabongs, and you'd bury your dead.
So how did these people end up in here?
In a lot of cases, you've got a person named Murray Black, who was a Scottish farmer in the early 19th century, who went along the Murray River and was given a fee, commission, by institutions like Melbourne University to dig up graves and collect the remains and any goods, grave goods, and they ended up at Melbourne University. Then from there they ended up in museums. Other people bartered with them. They would exchange stuff from overseas, for example, for Australian burial materials and skeletons. There was a trade in it.
It's a really interesting sort of thing to try to ponder. I mean, I've been working with human skeletal remains for over 25 years now. You start off from a very kind of academic perspective, if you like, but then after a while, absolute humanity just sort of rocks its way in, and you start to realise there are people who feel incredibly connected and very emotionally concerned about what you're doing, and also interested as well, in the sense that there's a lot of useful information that we can get from bones. We can talk about individual lives, if you like. We can talk about how old someone was when they died and what sex they were, and maybe diseases, maybe even the cause of their death, who knows. And those are things that people want to know about. It provides a very immediate sense of connection.
Let's describe what we're looking at here, because this is quite a large room, maybe the size of a double garage.
It is a room that's probably a little bit better than the old museum, but it reminds me of a mortuary, and that's essentially what it is—an academic cemetery, you know, used by academics to study our people. You've got the table over there where they pull the remains out and study them. You've got you've still got people coming in and studying and stuff. But I suppose this museum is probably one of the more excellent ones in the world, because it's got a pretty enlightened policy on repatriation. I think they've conceded that the wrong thing was done in the past, and in a way they're saying sorry, but also they're putting that into practice by allowing us to come into this institution and even resource our processes to bring our people down here and take them back home.
Gary Murray. Repatriation polarises people. It pits science against deeply held beliefs about the rights of the dead. The Cow Swamp Collection did that in 1990. Bones dating from the Pleistocene era, about 14,000 years ago, were excavated at Cow Swamp near Echuca. In 1990, the Museum of Victoria returned the cow swamp remains to the Yorta Yorta people. There was an uproar among prehistorians who said the bones were of vital interest to science because they were younger than bones they'd found at that other early human wonderland, Lake Mungo. But the cow swamp bones were vastly different. Mike Green takes up the story.
The people from Lake Mungo were very gracile. There was a male example and a female example, and they were both very gracile, slender sorts of people, whereas the people from Cow Swamp were very robust, very strong.
Can you maybe go through some of the arguments they put at the time for why this stuff should stay in the museum and why it shouldn't go home?
The argument is a very obviously sort of a scientifically focused one, in the sense that knowledge is public and knowledge is for all, and that really we shouldn't be doing anything that's going to prevent the advancement of knowledge. While you could argue that the results of the research might well be valuable, the means used to obtain it is just so abhorrent that we would not want to have anything to do with it. That's one argument. Mm-hmm. The other is, of course, that this is incredibly important. Ancestral remains, broadly speaking, from right across the world, are still a very important pillar of the study of human evolution and human variation. And it's just not just all about DNA, it still is about bones, and bones are very important. You ask any paleontologist, where DNA is right out of the question as far as they're concerned by and large, bones are still really important for science. And I think that this is the argument that's being put forward, certainly in the UK. Cambridge University and the Natural History Museum are arguing that their collections of Aboriginal remains are important for world knowledge.
Well, you know, there's still that, the old boys' network of academia that seem to think that there's a purpose to studying this material that outweighs the respect that we hold for our ancestors and dead. We, of course, tend to balance it in favour of our ancestors. You know, if this was me 300 years from now, I think I'd rather be in the ground than in a shelf like this.
But repatriation can be very difficult for museums. It's not simply a matter of opening the vaults. Provenance is a problem. Poor and hasty collection practices in the 19th century mean that today's museums don't have a lot to go on to identify exactly where bones belong. Mike Green.
It was extraordinarily difficult to return remains from the Murray Black collection for a number of reasons. I think first and foremost because we had so little information about it, about where they came from. I mean, George Murray Black was not a trained archaeologist, and so therefore the records that he kept were not very detailed in terms of where, from what location, precise geographic coordinates, someone so-and-so's paddock, at what depth were they obtained, all those sorts of things, and which would have been extraordinarily helpful if we'd had that information at the time, but we didn't. So there was a need to really go back into the archive and do an enormous amount of historical research, which was the subject of about 2 or 3 years' worth of work. And then also there was biological investigations of the remains as well to try and ensure that when we were talking about people, that we're actually separating out remains to the point where we could talk about individual people. And then, of course, that incredibly emotional experience of having to talk to Aboriginal communities about, well, we have remains, we know roughly where they come from, we think they're from your country, what would you like us to do with regard to their future?
There's discussion today about what to do with the thousands of unprovenanced remains in Australian museums. Rodney Dillon and the National Indigenous Repatriation Committee have a view.
Once again, those people have a right to be back in their country, and, you know, just like the unknown soldiers, there should be a grave, so a national keeping place for those people to be rested in their own country, even if we can't get them back to where they belong, and that keeping place be run by local Aboriginal people.
Back at the Museum of Victoria, Caroline Martin describes what actually happens at a repatriation ceremony.
The handing over of the remains from the organisation is actually done with the traditional owners of where the ancestors come from, and the CEO of this organisation actually provides a written apology and verbalises that apology, and it's so heartfelt, really heartfelt, and we actually acknowledge in that apology the past wrongs of this organisation, and so it's a very, very significant process for Aboriginal community and for us as staff members as well. I've been to many repatriation ceremonies, and every single one feels like I'm going to a funeral of someone that I've just lost.
So once the ancestral remains are returned to the traditional owners, a new set of issues arise. Rodney Dillon explains.
sometimes when people come back to the land where they're supposed to be, there's no land there, that the land's all privately owned. And what I think that should happen, councils, local councils and the Indigenous Land Council should be trying to acquire land in areas as close as locally to where those remains come back, and they should be rested in that area.
And some of the issues for communities are really difficult. I guess they have to organise themselves in particular ways to receive remains, and some communities aren't ready to do that yet.
No, that's a fact. Some communities are not ready sometimes, and they, and you know, there's remains in South Australia in the museum there. There's a lot of remains there that should be going back to their community and haven't gone back there yet, just through through politics and different things like that as well. There's lots of things that goes on when remains come home. Just like when other families, when there's a death in the family, sometimes it's an unsettled time in a family of people.
It can be certainly very lengthy and can be hellishly expensive, depending on what it is that people need to do. We've had instances where turnaround from the point of identifying our remains to a particular place, us either delivering the remains to them or them coming collecting them from us, ceremonial activity, reburial, be a matter of 6 to 12 months. Others can take a very, very long time because we might not be able to, and indeed nor would we want to insert ourselves in disputes within the community as to who is rightfully responsible for taking care of those old people.
The philosophy is bring them home and that's it. There's no compromise on that. The actual reburials and the rest of it, we can't always get it right because of the fact that there's a lack of information. You know, we're talking about remains that have probably been stolen 50 to 100 years ago.
I guess you'd be happy when you see this room empty.
Well, yeah, I think this one thing about this museum is that it's really, we've got to give it credit, even though it's got probably bad parts. I think its future's looking pretty rosy when it has such an enlightened policy that it will empty this storage room. It will only stay like this if we allow it to, in a sense that the communities don't get organised and access to resources that the museum's offering and the expertise, and get in here and take these people home. This is 150 years of white academia studying us. We've got to say, well, we've got to take the bad history with the good. We've got a shared history, whether we like it or not. And hopefully we can turn this bad history into something good, taking them home, which is what it's all about.
Give me water, give me fire. Don't give me monuments of stone. Give me rainbows in the sky. Give me back my land in which to lie. Make no monuments of moral grounds. Don't speak my name again when you lay me down. Don't speak my name again when you lay me down. Don't speak my name again when you lay me down. Never, oh, don't speak my name again when you lay me down.
Don't speak my name. The Pigram Brothers performing Kev Carmody's beautiful eulogy, ending that extract from the program Travelling Bones, first produced for Hindsight by me, Lorena Allam, and Mark Don in 2008. And thanks to all those who appeared in the program. If you'd like to hear the full program, then all you need to do is head to the Hindsight webpage, abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. Next week on the program, Luther's Children, a history of German settlement in the Barossa Valley of South Australia. The Lutherans came here as religious refugees, and they planted some of the first and the finest of Australia's vineyards. That's Luther's Children next week here on Hindsight on ABC Radio National.